listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast for corporate real estate and workplace leaders, where we talk about all things workplace and invite the people who are shaping the next generation of the office experience. I'm your host, Rafael Morgulis. In today's episode, I'm speaking to Markus Jarl. Markus is an associate partner in workforce advisory at EY Sweden. I met, or rather, I noticed Markus at a WorkTech event in Stockholm last summer. And I'm saying noticed because I didn't even need to hear the presentation that he actually did to be intrigued by him and to want to talk to him in our podcast. Because actually what really piqued my interest is when he presented himself, he told the audience that he was a behavioral scientist at EY Sweden. And that, I have to say, fascinated me. And so this is where we are. Hello, Markus. Thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Rafael. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, great to have you. So having said that, having introduced your kind of presentation, I'm pretty sure that our listeners will be at least as intrigued as I was to hear who you are and what you do especially. So I'll let you set the stage a little bit. Can you tell us more about you, your background and your role?
Yes, thank you. Well, as you said, I'm a behavioral scientist. I guess that's an interest that started fairly early in my life. I did the military service, as many people did many years ago, and I did it in the Swedish Air Force, where I was very intrigued and interested in leadership and how to build great teams, etc. So it was quite natural for me, having left the Air Force, to maybe pursue studies that was more in line with that. So I did quite a lot of behavioral science studies and also added some business administration to that. And then I've had the privilege of working in three large or medium-sized organizations on an international scale. And then for the last 12 years or so, I've been a consultant and working so much with leaders and teams and trying to really make sure that we are spending our time in a very sustainable, a good way, that it's good not only for the organization and the business, but also for the people.
And so now you are working in EY's workforce advisory. Can you explain to us what it is?
Yeah, well, so maybe EY is most well known for maybe audit services, etc. But there is also a big consultancy service line, as we call it. We are quite a lot of people with very different backgrounds. So it's a very diverse group of people. So we could have data analysts and technicians and people very good at real estate questions. And we have a lot of technical stuff going on as well. And then I come also then from this behavioral science side, which is not that common, at least not yet. So very interesting bunch of people that I'm working with very diverse backgrounds.
And then on the client side, so who are the typical stakeholders, or what are the kind of main drivers and challenges that bring organizations to you, to your practice?
The main thing is that they all need to change for some reason. And that could also depend. So an organization could come to us. It could differ very much, I guess, with who actually contacts us first. The request could come from maybe an HR side. Sometimes it's from a real estate side. Sometimes it's from maybe an IT side. It could be all these different reasons. And then depending on the challenge that the organization has in front of them, we compile a team of people that is best suited to actually try to deliver that change with the client, because it's always with the client. It's not necessarily for the client as well.
And when it comes to this need for change and the challenges that these organizations are facing, have you seen in the last few years a bit of a transformation or a change actually in these drivers or these challenges?
Well, it's a good question, because nearly all organizations need to change nearly all the time, right? It's more about the reasons for changing, I think, that differs. So we even see organizations that are doing really well. They have a big market share. They might be very, very profitable. They too need to change, which is to some extent a little bit contradictory, right? Because they're doing so well. And on the other hand, or the other part of the scale, so to speak, are organizations that need to change in order to survive. And I guess we have all these kinds of different organizations coming to us with different challenges that we most often could help out with, actually.
And I was then particularly interested in you and your work because you are positioned in a way that's helping organizations leverage research, data, and theoretical thinking to apply to their need for transformation, correct?
Yes, that's true. I think today we know that we have access to data, at least in many different forms and from that many different sources. The question quite often is, how do we actually transform that data into insights? And actually, based on those insights, what kind of actions do we take? And based on those actions, what kind of results do we get? But today, I think many organizations, they are maybe swimming in a pool of data and maybe are not able to truly derive any very wise insights on that. Or maybe the insights that they make is not necessarily the things that they truly need to address. So it is quite interesting, this data-rich day and age, how hard it is to actually come to really good insights.
And how then do you go about that? So for example, if we're talking about a topic that is very, very front of mind, let's say, for corporations at the moment, which is the office and the experience in the office or the experience in the organization, how can a company or corporation determine what are the insights that are needed or what are the predicting factors for office experience, for example?
Yes, that's a good question. I think it's very important to truly make sure that when we're speaking about workplace experience, workforce experience, etc., I think it's so important to truly match that to what's the business strategy. So why are we as an organization in our business? What kind of stakeholders do we have? What needs are we trying to meet for our clients, etc.? And then match that up and truly maybe create the conditions for the people in the organizations to actually be able to deliver on all those promises. And I think sometimes we look maybe at, you know, business challenges as maybe just a separate thing, right? Or workplace experience as a separate thing. But actually, it's sort of two sides of the same coin. So we could have loads of engaged employees, but maybe if we're not doing the right thing that is driving the organization forward, we could have this fantastic office and, you know, all the perks in the world. It still won't drive our organization forward, etc. So I think it's really the combination and finding that connection and driving that connection between the business strategy and the workforce strategy.
So you mentioned about this overload of data, and this is really what's where it becomes very important for corporations, for organizations to triage a little bit what you have in order to figure out what it is, what is it used for? How is it useful? If you can, for example, do a lot of surveys about employee sentiment, but if you don't necessarily know how it's going to be used to either change behaviors towards something that you want or change your bottom line as a business, what is it really useful for?
No, that's so true. And I think it's very much about operationalization really of that data, right? So how can we actually use that in the everyday in order to get smart and informed decisions? And quite a lot of organizations, they do employee surveys, you know, every quarter and so on. How do we actually just not make sure that it's just taking the temperature of where we are right now, but actually using that as something that we could drive the organization forward, and truly looking at what kinds of behaviors are we looking at that will drive our organization forward? And do we actually, for example, do we measure those kinds of behaviors? Do we reward those behaviors? That could also be quite an interesting thing.
Right. And then you mentioned behaviors. I guess from my point of view, there are different things that kind of affect or predict office or company culture. There's behaviors, which can maybe define as culture in a way. There's leadership and also kind of instructions, rules, etc. And then maybe a lot of things in between. So how does a corporation codify this, make sure that they have a clear grasp on what it is that actually predicts performance and office culture?
Yeah, well, that's a great and probably a $1 million question. But I think it's also coming back to this connection between, you know, business strategy and workforce strategy, and looking at what kinds of activities do we need to do. I do think also that leadership is super important in this when it comes to actually not only pointing sort of the way, where are we going, where we're heading, and trying to maybe stay a little bit ahead of the game, but also what kind of support systems do we have? How do we enable people actually to do a really good job? And I think one of the key important factors here is also that since most lines of business are really fast moving, I think it's also about how do we make sure to actually sort of build change into the organization and maybe even build innovation into the organization. In that sense, I think that maybe we have put too much focus on, okay, so the leaders need to drive the change. The leaders are there to support the change. And sometimes it's actually the people that are closest to clients and closest to the market. Those are the people who maybe know even more. They are maybe the most well-informed people of all. What kinds of things that are needed in different organizations today. And then it's more the role of a leader to catch that and be able to handle that and use that as a good decision for going forward.
That's really fascinating. I think this is something that I had seen on some of the materials that you have produced, which is this notion from EY to put humans at the center of transformation. And I think it's really interesting in the sense that no one would ever kind of say no to that statement. But then when you're in the middle of a transformation, it is really complicated and difficult, right? Like you were saying, leadership should not be the one that pushes, but it's more support. But how concretely, what would be kind of a, not the best practice, but how can it concretely be done?
What we've seen when we've done research on this is that leadership is absolutely crucial when it comes to truly providing the why and why do we need to change and what are we going to do and how does this position us from in the future, etc. And then truly being role models in the sense that truly believing in this also. So it's not only saying that this is important and then maybe doing something differently. So in that sense, it's very much the leaders that will be in the forefront of the change. But then when it comes to actually driving the change, then it's much more about creating these opportunities for people to start experimenting and trying out new things. And maybe also in a world where no one really has, not one person has all the answers, right? And I think that for many people and for many organizations, that is a feeling that is not very comfortable. Maybe in a few years ago or a number of years ago, there were these experts who knew everything. This is how we do it. We see it more and more that in order to have these really good informed decisions, we need to work together. That's truly how we can create leverage and truly understanding the present situation. So I think when it truly comes to driving, then that's when you truly need the culture or the population of the organization to do this together.
And still, it feels like we are, in some cases, quite far away from such a situation. I think when we talked previously, you mentioned this example of this productivity paranoia contradiction or paradox. And that's kind of the extreme opposite example, right?
Yes, I think so. And I think maybe that also comes back to this maybe old notion of what leadership or management would be like, right? Being, you know, the smartest person in the room, etc. And this term, productivity paranoia, I think it comes from a Microsoft report. And Microsoft is, of course, one of EY's key partners. And they did this study that was released in September there, where they asked employees, okay, so do you actually feel productive? And I think it was like 87% said, I am truly productive. And then they asked managers and leaders, do you really trust that the people that are working for you are productive? And 12% said, yes, we trust you. So there is this huge gap between how employees see their productivity, et cetera, and maybe the trust that is put in to do this. And I think we see that also in other research. I also know from another study that was actually done by Deloitte, where there was also this question about, okay, so how do you really feel right now? And how secure do you feel? And when you ask employees, it's like 60% say that I'm okay. But then when you ask managers, how are your people doing? It's like 85% say they're doing fine. So it's really this gap also what we think we see as managers or leaders and what's truly out there. That's an interesting aspect to it.
It's very interesting. And bringing that back a little bit closer to the concerns of the audience on the workplace in corporate real estate, we see exactly the same thing when it comes to the, let's say, the purpose or the why of the office, where probably if you ask a lot of, let's say, employees, they will say, yes, the office is nice, but I'm actually very productive at home, or it's actually more practical. And probably if you're asking managers, they will say, no, the office is great for culture, and it's great for a lot of different things. And you have this kind of, you know, not completely matching expectations.
No, you're right. And there is a lot of discussion going on here that work is not necessarily a place. It's more about what you do. So it's more about the why and the what rather than where. And which is an interesting concept. What's really interesting is I think it's very much down to what kind of business the organization is in. This is also important to remember that we have been able to work, you know, remotely and so on for, I don't know, 25 years or something like that. So we still could have a computer or laptop and working, you know, maybe from our summer house. And maybe we didn't have the best of connections, but we could do it. But we also do need to remember that there are still quite a lot of jobs and roles, etc., that are very fixed. And maybe there is a very limited possibility to actually do hybrid work or whatever we try to call it, right? It's truly about also understanding what kind of business are you in? Where does it truly require people? Where does it truly require people to be in one place? You know, maybe you're doing special kinds of research, maybe you're in a hospital, things like that. So that could be, we're in a warehouse. So that could be interesting. But then you have a number of roles, maybe in the same organization, that are much more hybrid. And then, of course, I do think that we have seen some examples of organizations that have said, okay, so you now need to come back to the office. And I just think that, okay, so they might have a good rationale for saying so. I mean, the consequences of that will be interesting to see. But there is some kind of rationale to it that they actually think that this is the place to do our work is at the office. It's the same thing as the when, the why, the what, and the where is the, sort of the same thing.
That's fascinating because it makes me think you were talking about the need of expertise. But for example, where the work is done and what does it require. So for example, for my role, I will know the tasks that I have to do and how much time it takes me and what kind of conditions I will perform this task the best in. But is it possible to expect that my manager, who might not have any experience in that particular function, to understand this, to, you know, really, you know, if you're a manager and you have, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 people under your supervision, you cannot be expected to know in what conditions all these different people do their best jobs? Or is that the new requirement for management, actually?
It's interesting. I think it is very much about how we do work and how we work together. So what we also see, of course, is that maybe the traditional hierarchical way of being organized is maybe being replaced to more project-based work, etc. So what quite often happens is that in those small systems of work, these projects, etc., they are the ones that are truly good at defining what do we need to learn and what kind of people do we need, etc. It's, as you say, probably as a manager, and we've seen in some organizations, you could have up to 50 people or more even reporting to you. And in those kinds of situations, it's absolutely impossible to do that. What we do see when there is still hierarchical organizational forms, we do see that when managers actually have these constant dialogues with their people, you know, one-on-ones, weekly, etc., you absolutely build, you know, a trusting relationship and people feel that they can speak about all those things that are working well and things that are not working. And that's absolutely doable. And then all of a sudden you understand more and more, even though you're not directly involved in maybe the day-to-day work with your people. So there is absolutely a possibility to do it, even if there is a more traditional form of organizing. But I do really want to say that what we see more and more is maybe leaving the hierarchy and going into maybe what could be called wirearchy. So we're wired together in a different way and not based on hierarchical teams.
That's super interesting. And so that makes me transition perfectly to my next question, which is, can you explain to, let's say, a 5 or 7 year old, what are the bigger picture objectives now for workforce for large organizations?
Ooh, to a 5 or 7 year old, I really like that metaphor. Now, I guess it's actually down to the fundamentals. It's so important to truly go back to, so why do we exist as an organization? For whom are we creating a difference in the everyday for you? And how are we actually creating that value for you? And then maybe sort of as a 7th question or so, it would be, okay, so in order to do this, where can we do that work? It's so important to truly start with that big picture. For many organizations, I think that maybe these questions, you know, why do we exist and so on, it's a given. But the larger the organizations grow, it's not a given for new hires in large organizations. And then you will also have these smaller parts of an organization that maybe work with different clients and so on. So truly also being able to do that exercise also with teams and parts of the organizations that maybe are doing different things that's different to other parts of the organization. And truly painting that big picture, why do we exist and what do we do? And then how do we do it? And then, of course, where do we do it?
I really like that image of asking where should the work be done is kind of a 7th or even later question, because now the building is there, so we don't necessarily ask the question. Or even when we create an organization kind of ex nihilo, then it's automatic that we'll have a building, we'll have a place, we have to register it, we have to have a center or whatever. But it's out of tradition or automatism rather than function and, okay, what's the best way for the organization?
Yes.
But is it really feasible also for example, large companies that have been there for a really long time that probably have invested a lot of money in new headquarters, for example, or any kind of built environment? How feasible is it to re-question that?
No, I think it's a good question. One thing that is interesting is that when you look at larger corporations, they have been used for many years to actually work over distances and remotely in a different way than many other organizations have done. And we know that many organizations that they have offices in all over the world. And some of these people that are working maybe daily, weekly together, they've never met, right? So this happened even before the pandemic. Now, what could also be interesting is, of course, to also add in the sustainability factor here with the environmental sustainability. I mean, we couldn't just ignore that factor here. So what we, of course, saw during the pandemic was that many organizations actually did really bad, right? So because that was the line of business that they were in didn't even exist. So, I mean, you take the example of these organizations that arrange, you know, football travel that absolutely just disappeared overnight, right? Because you couldn't fly. And if you could fly, you couldn't even attend the game, right? So that line of business were out. But you had a number of other industries that truly were thriving. And all of a sudden, they did that without also the travel. So, of course, we are probably going to travel, still going to travel, but not at all to the extent that we do. When we look at, you know, the environmental footprint of many organizations, it is very much, you know, offices and travel. So there are some really smart things that we do need to change as we also look at the big scheme of things. And we've seen examples that this has been working before. And we truly need to ask ourselves the questions, why do we need to meet? I mean, yeah, there will absolutely be great opportunity. I'd have loved to done this interview with you, Rafael, you know, in person. But yeah, there are a number of other factors that we can take into account why we actually do this the way we do it right now.
This is such a good point, because I remember one of my previous companies, there was an humongous amount of money that was spent in business travel every year, because it was a very, very international organization. And Well, obviously, with the pandemic, that was completely stopped. And so, in a way, the organization realized from one day to the next, well, that was not entirely necessary. Why do we need crisis like this to realize that?
That's also one of those million-dollar questions, right? And it's so interesting because there are also all these other studies looking at crisis that people have been subjected to. And one of the most famous one is, you know, these cancer patients that were given the idea that, okay, so if you don't change, you will die, right? And it's like 1 in 7 actually makes the change. So it's not even enough with a crisis. What we're looking at also, what we're finding more and more is that, you know, norms quite often creates the change. So when enough people actually start making that change, that's when we also start to change. So there will always be some early adopters, right, who will do whatever is new, right, and what seems to be very plausible and good for the environment or for the business and so on. But there will always be quite a lot of people who might resist it, and maybe it's just because we don't know what to do and so on. But when this new way of doing things becomes sort of the norm, that's when it becomes truly interesting. And taking the train to conferences, and it's also an interesting concept in how to do that as well.
That's such a good point, because we see it in our business, right? Now in corporate real estate, in workplace in general, there is a consensus that data is needed, is necessary in order to kind of future-proof the organization, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, almost every new conversation that we have with potential customers, for example, starts with, what are the others doing? What are your customers currently doing? And this is exactly what you mentioned, right? It's like, rather than experimenting on your own and trying and failure, it might be more comfortable or more, I don't know, less risky to just say, okay, what are the others doing? Even if it might not be completely adapted to your situation.
You're right. And there are all these data, and they are different depending on which lens you're looking from, of course. And you could have it from a real estate perspective. It's quite often about maybe square meters, et cetera. And then you could hear about, they're, you know, this company, whatever, they're down to, you know, 4.1. And it's like, wow, we can do that. Well, that depends on what you're doing, right? So it's not about being completely blind and honed in on these square meter numbers, right? It's very much about, okay, so what do you actually need in order to not only stay in business, but actually thrive, right? And we also see organizations like Airbnb. I mean, they've scrapped the office as a whole, right? They don't have an office. So is that where we want to go? I'm not so sure. I mean, there's still absolutely a need for an office. The question is more about, okay, so what do we really use it for? And what we see more and more is that people come to the office to hang out, you know, to truly spend time together with other people. We see some tendencies sometimes also that because of my maybe social situation where I am right now, I might be a very young person living in my first apartment. I live together with someone else who's also on all these Teams calls all day, right? So the work environment at home is not very good. So I go to the office to do some work, absolutely. So there are also these factors that we need to take into consideration when planning the office. But I do think that this idea about getting together in an office is absolutely a really, really good thing, making sure that we use that for true collaboration and hanging out.
That makes me laugh, because if I was being completely honest, I would say that my best conditions for work, for me personally, is actually the office, but empty, if no one was there, because then it would be perfect conditions. And still having some sort of collaboration and social interaction every now and then. But yeah, I like the focus work, but at home you have the distraction. So actually the office being empty is the perfect case.
That's the perfect. It's interesting. You know, we've also looking at some statistics and some other studies that was done before the pandemic. And for some people, it was so obvious that if they were going to do something that required focus, the best way to do it is actually at home, because in the office, it was too noisy, too crowded, whatever. But then again, it's very much about a little bit of discipline, as you say, not being too distracted by other stuff. But that's also interesting to see how quickly we have maybe forgotten how it was before the pandemic. It's like everything we did before the pandemic, it was so fantastic. You know, we have all these great meetings and so on. But we also know that so many people thought that we had too many meetings, meetings that were really, really bad. We missed out on bringing people together and all those things. And what we also see is, of course, that depending on where we are in life, these hybrid models could also help us out. When we have periods, maybe we have smaller children, we don't have to, you know, rush to the office after leaving at kindergarten, et cetera, et cetera. So those factors and those things about being able to cater for different periods of life, that's also such an interesting concept to look at from an organizational perspective. And maybe not losing a lot of people when they are 35 and they have small children and they just realize this is a hopeless organization to be in at this moment in life. I mean, there are so many opportunities to explore.
One thing I really wanted to mention or ask you, because as I said in the introduction, I was very intrigued by how you presented yourself as a behavioral scientist. And for me, this was interesting because I had this vision of EY as a kind of big black box full of consultants that have been consultants since they're 25 or something like this. And I really did not expect, I didn't have that open-mindedness of thinking of EY as an organization that would use and mobilize more of an intellectual perspective in their work. Why do you think there is this evolution, if it is one, to actually incorporate other points of view in such a line of business?
One of the factors is really also about diversity and inclusion and diversity of thoughts and backgrounds and all that. EY, I mean, to my knowledge, is really, really good at this. And I mean, we could all do better, I guess. But it's also, as you say, it's easy to think that, okay, so if you only have this picture of EY as being an audit company, which I could also absolutely confess that that was my picture of it when I joined, right? Or at least before joining, because it didn't take more than maybe my first meeting. Here, I understood that this is different. That's one of the key things. But then it's also about, it's one thing to hire for diversity, but then it's a completely different thing also using that diversity to your advantage. Because it's easy to think that, yeah, we're going to hire all those people, but then we're going to do the same thing as we've always done. Then you wouldn't have inclusion, right? So you could go for diversity, but if we're not able to include people, that's a different challenge. And for many organizations, I think that's a little bit of the challenge today. So we hired a lot of diverse people, but then that is hard, right? Then I have to listen differently. We have to do things differently. And then all of a sudden, it's so easy maybe to go back to what we used to do.
And I guess that comes a lot from, if you understand that you need to have different types of answers to the questions that you're facing, then you will actually go for a diversity that's useful, not necessarily for image, let's say. But if you're not convinced that you need to have different types of answers, that's going to be less meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. And back to this maybe old notion of, you know, I'm the smartest person in the room. And still, if you still think that, I mean, why would you need all those other people for? So it's very much about maybe harvesting or truly making sure that we're having this culture of listening to each other and really valuing everyone's opinions. And it's such an easy thing to say, and it's hard to do in the everyday when we're sitting with these big proposals or big challenges, and all of a sudden it's, we'll do it as we've always done, because I know the best. I've done it so many times. So yeah, so humility and curiosity is truly something that we need to find out more.
So that leads me to a very good question here. How you as an expert in let's say, workforce or organizational culture, how do you see this evolving in the coming years? Meaning, if you could try to predict some very, very great progress that you think will happen in the next few years, or also some great failure where organizations will fail at something in that area, what would it be?
No, it's a great question. We have all these fantastic progress in so many areas, right, with the technology, et cetera. And we know looking back maybe 50, 60 years ago, there were these future scientists. They looked into the future and said, by the year 2022 or something, we're going to work much less and so on. And life's going to be less about work. It's much better balance and so on. But what we're seeing is, of course, maybe the complete opposite, right? So people are still working super hard. We do know that way too many people are on sick leave because of mental health issues and stress and so on. So I really do hope that we can, and also believe that there is absolutely a possibility to build this better working world, which is not only about work, right? Which is more about life in general. And that's something that I truly believe in. And how can we make sure that we can create these conditions where maybe organizations can still thrive, but it's not at the expense of the people in the organization, but actually thanks to being super smart about how we actually do things.
What is the most creative or experimental thing that you've done in the workplace so far in your career?
I guess we started very early on doing very interactive workshops and meetings using Skype. So I used to work with Microsoft a lot. So we did quite a lot of early experiments doing really large scale workshops using very much the chat as the only way of creating interactivity. And it was quite amazing how much interactivity you could create. And that sort of, I guess, planted this idea that, maybe we don't need to be in a room together to actually create interactivity and ideas and so on. And this is about 10 years ago. So that was one thing that got me started, I think. Maybe half not believing that this would work, which was interesting as well. But it did work and it's just evolved. And all of a sudden now everyone is doing these interactive meetings. Still quite a lot of people have, we can learn a lot. But using these tools for us to create this inclusion and interactivity and so on, I think it's amazing.
Kind of a follow-up to that. Do you see the metaverse as being a possible kind of next step, next evolution that from what you describe as the kind of very initial steps working with the chat and it's not perfect, etc. And now we're getting better at this because hybrid is making it very kind of the norm. So next step could be the metaverse. How do you see this?
It could be. I don't know. I mean, I'm old enough to have also come across something called Second Life, which was something that was a little bit of a hype maybe 20 years ago or something. Nothing happened really with that. It was very Minecrafty versions. The metaverse is probably something much more powerful. Will be truly interesting to see. I do think absolutely that once again, coming back to different organizations, and how they create value, in what way could we then use metaverse, for example, to create value for our clients, etc. That, I think, is very much about experimentation. It's not about only thinking, oh, wow, this we could do this. Yeah, well, it is applying it also to everyday issues that we're struggling with. And that's when it becomes truly interesting.
Can you think of something in your area, of an idea or something that you've seen being implemented or experimented with that immediately you thought, oh, if I could have come up with that?
Well, all the time, I guess. with the key word that you're mentioning there, Rafael, is really experimenting. Because I do think that there are so many brave people in brave organizations that are not afraid to do some experimentation. When you do experiments, it's not that you know exactly these are the outcomes, this is what will happen, and this will work, right? So when we do experiments, we know that quite often we will fail, but we will not fail maybe in that sense. We will learn. I read about all these fantastic experiments all along in different parts of the business, within EY, etc. And I just think it's so interesting that in some parts, you know, in different organizations, there is this openness to experimentation. There is this openness to failure, even within quote marks, instead of maybe going for the safe bet or the safe card. No, we will do it as we've always done it. So every time I have the opportunity to do some experiments, I quite often look at, okay, so what has actually been tried a little bit before and maybe learn from that.
Great. Last question from me. Who do you think we should reach out to as a next guest for our podcast?
Ooh, there are so many interesting people. And of course, many of the persons that I look up to and really think they're so clever. one of my favorites, who is maybe a little bit controversial, maybe. There is this neuroscientist called Lisa Feldman Barrett. I've heard her a number of times. I also hear sometimes she gets a little bit of criticism. I think she's so inspiring. So maybe Lisa Feldman Barrett would be my answer.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. It was a really, really great conversation. And I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed this very much.
Thank you, Rafael. And also thanks to my colleague, Michael, who supported me in this as well. So thank you.
Thank you. I met Marcus at a WorkTech event. And I think from the moment he presented himself as a behavioral scientist, I kind of knew that this was someone I wanted to talk to. And this is actually leading me to a bit of an introduction for this episode. So you see, for me, this was a bit of a surprise when I heard about a behavioral scientist being featured or presented by Ernst & Young. And probably for a lot of people, it's not necessarily a surprise at all, and it's totally normal. But for me personally, I didn't have that representation of Ernst & Young. For me, I had this cliche of a obviously hugely successful consulting services company, but as such, full of consultants that kind of have been born and bred into the consulting realm. And so to hear about a behavioral scientist, which kind of evokes more of an academic perspective on things, that was quite a surprise, a positive surprise, because I was very pleased to realize that the cliche I had about Ernst & Young was totally wrong. It kind of made me think about all these cliches that we have, these kind of superficial representations of certain things in the work environment. So for example, Ernst & Young, I have this view, this simplistic view of Ernst & Young, because I haven't really been too involved with big consulting companies in my career, only sparingly a few times. And because I've had some interactions with consulting, I kind of get what they do, but also haven't had the experience and opportunity to really grasp their full complexity. So in a way, I know what it is, but I don't really know what it is. And I've seen that, for example, from another perspective as well. So kind of same, similar superficial understanding of something. So for example, in content and marketing, I have gained firsthand experience with SEO, search engine optimization. I'm not an expert, but I understand the mechanics and the complexity of SEO fairly well. And I can see very quickly when I'm talking about SEO with someone who only grasps it only superficially, pretty much as well as I grasp big consulting. Someone who has an idea about SEO, but doesn't really get SEO and his kind of complexities. And that's actually the case of a lot of people in marketing. But there are other areas or categories or topics in the workplace that many, or maybe even a majority of people in the workplace function, have an idea about, but don't really know. And I think, for example, diversity and inclusion is one such area. And full disclosure, I'm mentioning that area because I totally think I know about it, but I don't really know it. And this is really one of these things where if I'm in a meeting and the subject comes on the table, either it stays at a rather superficial level and I feel I can participate, or it goes in depth and then I'm not comfortable at all with the subject. And this is where there's a 90% chance that I will just try to go through that and pass through the drops and hopefully not to have to be embarrassed by my lack of knowledge on that topic. And I think, for example, data, workplace data, is another example. We all kind of know that it's important, but data, when you're not a specialist, it's actually quite a hard topic. If you didn't study math, for example, or if you were more of a social science person, reality is that your comfort level with numbers will most likely be medium to low. And then there's also the difference between data and data. Just like in marketing, it's one thing to look at a simple metric like occupancy average or the open rate of an email. And then you can work around that one simplistic view of what performance is translated in numbers. It's a completely different story when you have to deal with workplace analytics, different types of data sets, continuous data, multiple levels of granularity, and completely different qualities of data. That requires a completely different understanding of the topic. And so maybe there's a lot of people that are kind of going through the same, let's say, experience as I am when diversity and inclusion comes on the table. They're not feeling that great about their level of comfort on the subject, but they also don't really want to let that known because it's not really accepted or it's kind of frowned upon. honestly, that should be okay, in the sense that it's not okay that I don't know that much about diversity and inclusion, and I know that, and I should be way more knowledgeable about the subject, and I feel a bit guilty about this. But at the same time, we cannot know everything. Our work lives are so complicated now. We cannot be expected to have an opinion and have a great understanding of every single topic. And so we should also give us some slack there every now and then. And it's fine if you're not perfectly understanding what workplace analytics really means. Maybe you can rely on some of your colleagues for that. And that should be perfectly normal. Same as I shouldn't feel guilty when I realize, oh, my understanding of what Ernst & Young or big consultancy is, was actually kind of wrong. Yeah, our brains are so full today, we really sometimes should just give ourselves a bit of a break.
Yeah, I mean, we need to give ourselves a lot of grace in all topics. I think that's a downside to a society where we have so much information, is that we expect everybody to know everything. And people often say things like, you know, it's wrong if you don't understand something correctly, but it's also wrong if you don't know it in the first place. But how do you know what you don't know if you've never gotten the opportunity, the chance to ask about it? And we get in this box of being nervous to bring something up, being nervous to learn more about something out of fear that people will find out that we don't know about it. But how are we supposed to learn? That's with everything. And we're expected to have opinions on everything, which makes it difficult. And you see this not only in the workplace, you see this also in your personal life, whether it's politics or environmental concerns. Everyone wants you to be able to speak on everything, but we're only human and we can only be, for one, interested in so many things. But secondly, actually have opinions that are well-informed is another matter. And yeah, I can see that happening in the workplace a lot with everything. I mean, look at our own offices. I can say what people in marketing do confidently because I'm in marketing and that's what I experience day to day. When we get into the development teams or the product teams, that my knowledge starts to go really surface level. And I love to learn about it. But even when I start to learn about it, that will take weeks, months for me to actually develop an understanding of how these teams function within one another.
And the difficulty here is, how do you realize when your level of understanding of something is superficial or it's not? So for example, you mentioned our development colleagues, and I know some of it because I've worked with some developers and I've talked to them about what they do, and I understand some of their methodologies, for example. So I have some sort of understanding, maybe a little bit deeper than yours, for example, on how they work and what they do and all these things. But at the same time, I'm extremely far away from having a clear picture of what is their challenges or what are their challenges or how do they organize themselves and everything like that. And it's the same for so many other topics. It's like you gain a little bit of understanding of how much is enough. That's also difficult, right? How do you know? It's a bit of at some point it becomes a confidence thing where, okay, I'll never know enough of anything because you can always be more of an expert, but how much is enough in order to have an opinion on something? That's also quite complicated. It puts you in this position where if a topic comes on the table, it becomes really almost a conscious attitude thing where either I'm going to be deciding that I know enough and I'm going to confidently intervene, but I might actually not know at all anything, or I decide I need to learn more because I don't feel confident about my own understanding of the topic. And then you'll just raise your hand, for example, or just say anything, which is also possible. And maybe you'll lose an opportunity because you actually had an interesting kind of contribution to make on that topic. So that's really interesting.
And actually, it brings up a completely different topic of the fallacy of expertise. Do you need to be an expert in everything in order to have any opinion on it? Maybe you won't have the full depth of knowledge on a subject, but does that mean that your opinion, your suggestions on it can't be valid or inform people or the subject in a different way?
No, exactly. Yeah, that's very, very true. You shouldn't have to be an expert, especially in order to innovate and have kind of fresh ideas, etc. It's actually better if you probably are not an expert in anything, because you then have not been, let's say, completely biased by certain source of information or things like that. I think this is really interesting. That kind of brings back to the topic of management, because at the end of the day, for example, if you're in a meeting or in a workshop, you need to have a structure and you need to have a way of animating the different people that are participating so that every angle, every approach can be represented and participate on an equal footing. If you only let the brainstorm be about who's the most expert, then you're going to miss something. And it's the same in the regular, let's say, day-to-day life of the organization. You need to have an intentful way of bringing every contribution or perspective on things so that it can actually contribute to the better results. You know that it's bad if you only keep things among experts, because at some point you're going to run in circles. But at the same time, if you bring everyone every time, on every topic, it's also going to be extremely messy. And so that's really interesting, because that requires, a lot of good management.
Yeah, I think that's where you run into the problem of, I think it's logical to want to have only experts on a topic, thinking that you get the best quality information that way. But experts, unfortunately, get pigeonholed in their perspectives a lot of the time. And you see that in education or in medicine, where actually the people who innovate are the ones who came from a completely different topic and said, hey, this doesn't really make sense what you're saying here. Let me explore this. And how do we force these serendipitous experiences? How do we do that?
Again, there's a lot of methodologies or best practices in how do you actually make sure that everyone can participate on equal footing. And then if there's a need of deep diving, that takes on another level. But if I think that brings me to something that I saw the other day around meetings, and what exactly do you want from a meeting? Is it an information meeting? Is it a co-creation meeting or things like that? And depending on the type of intention that you have, you need to run it completely differently. Say, so for example, if it's an opportunity to gather as many, let's say, perspectives as possible, then you need to organize things in a certain way. And you need to make sure that there are, let's say, time boxes and things like that, so that everyone can participate and have the possibility to bring their own perspective. And then there's the other part of that, is not just equal participation, but also making sure that there is no, let's say, judgmental process that comes with that, that no one, you know, if you open it to every participant and you say, hey, you have to bring your perspective, whatever your expertise, because that might be actually fruitful, then you also need to make sure that no one in the room is going to say, no, I don't think this is valid, because that is, you know, it's not enough to just open the floor. You also have to make sure that everything is kind of considered and considered equally without judgment. But that's if you're in this type of setting, for other types of intentions, you might want to run completely differently. But that is essential. And I think we are often too, well, I'm going to give us grace here, and I'm not going to say lazy, but we are often too busy to really think about what's our intention for that particular occasion. Because we run meeting after meeting and task after task, and then you're like, oh, meeting is now, I barely had time to prepare. I'm already going to prepare what this is about. And then do you even have time to prepare how I'm going to run this? This is too complicated.
That's our next episode, is how to run meetings.
Thanks for listening. We will soon be back for more. And in the meantime, go visit our blog at loketi.com and have a look at the other topics we have covered, or stay tuned for more episodes of The Workplace Leader.